Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spectacular.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, we're skipping controversies and controversy. Peter, is that a controversy or a controversy?
I don't know, Sonny. You know, it's obviously controversial that we're doing it, but it's a controversy that's
typical Suderman. Alyssa.
It's controversial. It's hot. It's summer. There are a bunch of movies out, and we're talking about those instead.
Too many movies. All right, because we're just going to jump right into the movies.
That's
this week.
The real controversy. Too many movies.
Too many movies. We're jumping right into the movies this week because we got two to discuss. That's right. It's a two movie week for the kids and the parents. We got Inside Out 2, which is shattering box office records. For the grown folk, we've got The Bike Riders, which put up healthy numbers as well, despite being dumped by the good folks at Disney to Focus Features. Let's start with the kids first. We're gonna start with the kids, and then we'll move over to the adults. Inside Out 2. Is the first breakout smash of 2024. The 10 years later sequel to Pixar's hit about feelings that have feelings is Pixar's first real hit in a long time. It grossed $154 million in its opening weekend, and perhaps even more shockingly, another $100 million in its second weekend. That's a huge number. The opening weekend number was the second best opening ever for an animated film. The second weekend was the best second weekend ever for an animated film. And it's also the first second weekend since 2019's Avengers Endgame to gross more than $100 million in that second weekend. Movies, they're back, baby, they're back. But is it any good? We talk about box office, whatever. Is it any good? It's very fine. It's fine. This movie is fine. Riley, the little girl from the first film who had to deal with the emotions, joy, anger, sadness, disgust, and fear doing battle in her head, is hitting puberty. Puberty means an influx of new emotions. So we're introduced to anxiety, envy, ennui, and embarrassment. When Riley heads to hockey camp and learns that she'll be attending a different high school from her group of friends, her new emotions kick into overdrive, attempting to help her ingratiate herself with a new group of hilariously diverse girls who are super good at hockey. Anxiety, voiced by Maya Hawke, is the star of this show. She's a whirling dervish of manic energy whose fear of the future drives the action. She imprisons the original group of emotions in a bottle. They're bottled up emotions. You see, they're bottled up. And consigns them to a vault containing lost memories. They break out of the vault, travel down the stream of consciousness. It's a little actual stream. It's a literal stream of consciousness. I hope you get it. And attempt to make their way back to the back of Riley's mind, where anxiety has consigned Riley's sense of self. You see, anxiety has replaced Riley's idea that she's a good person with the idea that she has to be a winner. And if she isn't a winner, she'll be doomed to failure. In my written review, I gave Inside Out 2 the softest possible thumbs up that I could. Like, on the one hand, it's fairly amusing. There are a couple of really good gags, like a Blue's Clues style memory who talks to the viewing audience. And when I saw this movie with a group of, there were kids in the audience, and some of them talked back to the screen. They were answering the cartoon. It was like a funny call and response bit, which, you know, is I don't know that they necessarily intended for that to happen, but it did happen. Or there's another very funny moment where anxiety turns Riley's imagination against her, right? Imagine a room full of animators devising torments for a teen girl. But it's all gratingly literal, and it's filled with the sort of therapy speak that I've really come to resent over the years. Like, I'm sorry. I've had enough with people talking about people need to internalize and frankly bottle up more of their emotions. That's what that's where I have come down on all this. The whole mood is probably best summed up when anxiety says to Joy, quote, "You just aren't what she needs anymore, Joy," end quote. Please tell me you get it. Subtlety, not exactly this movie's bag. Alyssa, what did you make of Inside Out 2? And importantly here, I'm curious, did you take your kids to see it? Or was this just you?
Just me. Okay. My kids are still just not quite into the movies, and that's okay. It's just like the most Alex P. Keaton thing possible for a movie critic to have kids who are like, movies, not that into them. I agree with you. This is sort of relentlessly fine. There is nothing as sort of audacious as what the first movie does with Bing Bong, Riley's imaginary friend, who starts out the film as this like unbelievably ridiculous sort of grotesque character and makes this gesture of self-sacrifice that is such as like completely destroys me every time I watch the movie. And I think there are, you know, I think Sunny is right that part of the problem is that all the gags in this movie are too literal. But also, this is a movie that is sort of unwilling to commit to any particularly difficult ideas about emotions. And the most interesting of these might actually be that anxiety has a useful role to play in people's lives. Like, you know, Riley's anxieties do actually, before anxiety gets totally out of control in her head, does kind of push her to like build up a social bulwark and try to make some new friends and to, you know, like pursue some sort of drive and ambition. But the movie isn't quite willing to argue that like maybe a little sort of anxiety and fear are good motivators, but it's also unwilling to fully commit to the idea that like Riley might have a mental health crisis, right? I mean, she has this sort of brief panic attack and then like she's fine. Her emotions have sorted themselves out. And look, Disney and Pixar are not studios that are going to make deep movies about the, you know, the youth mental health crisis in America. But, you know, the inability to say anything really audacious about either Riley in particular as a character or feelings in general ends up making the movie feel a little bit weightless. You know, Matt Iglesias actually wrote an interesting like entry in his Substack about one thing about the movie that he found kind of strange, which is the sort of complete acceptance the movie shows for the idea that it's a good thing for Riley to be and her friends to be competing in like unbelievably competitive youth sports, and sort of making that the center of their existence. Since this actually is something that is kind of a growing social problem, there's a bit of an arms race in youth sports where kids get sort of like not professionally tracked, but get very tracked into aggressive training programs quite early. The concentration, sports participation has become concentrated among wealthier kids as these leagues get more expensive to participate in. And so, you know, it's a movie that is divorced from that and kind of from other questions about being a teenager today. Like, you know, there's this sort of one subplot moment where the kids just like give up their phones. And it frees the movie from having to deal with kids and phones at all. And so, you know, the world that Riley is operating in is in some ways as artificial as the world that her emotions are living with inside her head. And so, yeah, it's momentarily funny, but the big emotional moment here is Joy saying it's like, maybe that's what happens when you grow up, you need less joy. And it's like, again, nothing compared to the Bing Bong self-sacrifice moment in Inside Out 2, just not even close.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I kind of keyed on in my review is that the series of movies are shifting away from more universal emotions to more specific and narrow ones. So, for example, anxiety is really just a subset of fear, right? Yeah. Anxiety, like, there's already fear in the movie. Anxiety is a specialized kind of fear. It's the fear of the future, fear of the failure that you might is ennui really even emotion? Would you describe, if somebody had said to you before this film, would you describe ennui as an emotion?
It's sort of like a state of being. And again, that this would be like, you might have had a more fruitful and interesting movie if you had some sort of contest between ennui and anxiety, right? It's like if Riley is like, you know, pulled between like terror of not succeeding and a sense that like, maybe she's just burned out and wants to relax. Like that probably would have been a more interesting movie about like, you know, sort of Riley's emotions and who she is. But because you have Amy Poehler as Joy and she's wonderful, and because she's the main character who you're following from the first movie to the second, you know, the movie, again, sort of couldn't do anything deeper and more difficult with, you know, Riley actually thinking about like who she wants to be.
Yeah, my point here, though, was more that, like, I was watching this in my own head, right? The first movie, a bunch of emotions that I think everyone kind of relates to. I am not naturally a very anxious person, so when I see anxiety getting lots of screen time, I'm like, oh, that's weird. That's not what I'm like, and therefore, it doesn't quite work for me in the same way.
But you've been on Twitter. And you know that anxiety is a big deal for a lot of people.
Sure. I mean, no, undoubtedly, there are a lot of anxious people out
there. This is the anxious generation, is my understanding.
Well, and, like, to be non-jokey about it, like, I'm someone who has diagnosed clinical anxiety. It's, like, it's played an enormous role in my life. And I do find that sort of, that is a subject interesting, but I didn't find the treatment of anxiety terribly interesting here. Again, like, without being flip about it, I think it's like, it's a, even as someone whose life has been profoundly shaped by anxiety and is not anymore, thank goodness, I didn't find this to be sort of a particularly profound treatment of that as a disorder, as opposed to, or even necessarily as an emotion, not least because, like, when anxiety just totally takes over and there's no tension with any of the other emotions, you lose some sort of plot engine there. And also, like, you know, Sunny, you're talking about the relationships between the kinds of emotions, right? Like, ennui could potentially be a facet of sadness. Anxiety is potentially, you know, sort of a facet of fear. But, like, joys, the sort of relentless focus on joy is in of itself like a manifestation of anxiety, right? Like, joy is herself an incredibly anxious character. And the movie does nothing with that either.
Yeah, that is almost precise. Thank you for putting my thoughts into, thank you for putting my emotions into words, Alyssa.
It's like you're an emotion inside Sunny's head.
Let me tell you guys, it's really fun in there.
I don't know about that. The movie is relentlessly like, yeah, this is pretty good. It's occasionally very clever. I'm mostly just glad folks went to go see it, frankly. We've been talking all year about the kind of lack of family movies, and, you know, there was If that came out a month or two back, and then the Garfield movie, and those have done okay. But this is a bona fide smash hit. It is currently outpacing Barbie at the box office. We'll see if it's able to keep that up. But, you know,
so
it's,
what
it's,
accounts
it's a big
for that?
Hit.
I mean, I can point to a bunch of factors, right? Like, it is the sequel to a hugely popular film that people have heard of, right? That drives ticket sales. It came out in a relative family movie desert, right? And that's important too. Sonny, you have been hitting that note for over a year here, and you have been correct that the family film, the dearth of family films has been a huge driver of the lack of box office. It also came out during a heat wave, and that seems to have impacted ticket sales at least a little bit. Historically, that has often been the case in the summer, is that people go to the movies just because it's hot out and you need to be inside in the air conditioning. And that has been the case. So, you know, global warming, great for the box office. It's going to save the movies. But the reaction here seems a little bit outsized. Like, I can't figure out why Inside Out 2. Why this? I mean, Pixar has not been knocking them out of the park for the past 6 or 8 years here.
I have a couple thoughts on this, a couple theories. One is that in addition to just being a general, you know, family desert drought, this is also a movie that kids are primed to see because they are sitting at home and they're watching Inside Out on Disney Plus. So this is like, it's like, oh, Disney Plus. I like Disney Plus for watching
streaming
it. It's on the homepage
synergy
of Disney. This is the flywheel in action. This is audiences, watching the old thing to get ready for the new
funnel.
One. But also, I mean, look, I think this is, I think an important thing to think about and something that critics are often very hesitant to admit and embrace, which is that people like franchises. People like sequels to things they liked.
And this is Pixar sequel in 5 years since before the pandemic. Or I actually, sorry, that's not true. Lightyear doesn't count. Like, Lightyear
Lightyear is a spinoff.
What is Lightyear?
But a spinoff. Not a, but not a
real direct sequel.
Yeah. So it's the first sequel in 5 years. And I also think, like, Inside Out, you know, I think has, in addition to just people watching the old stuff, like, has huge nostalgia value, right? Like, if your kid was, you know, 5 or 6 when Inside Out came out in 2015, like, they're right at the same. It has been released at a cadence so that the audience has grown up with the movie. And, you know, for a lot of parents, there is a lot of focus on emotions, finding a way for to talk to your kids about them. You know, I've talked on this podcast about how my daughter is not that comfortable with movies, but Inside, the original Inside Out is one of the few that she's made it all the way through. So I think that, like, I think all of the factors that you're talking about are true, but I would not underestimate just, like, real fondness for the original and the movie as a schema for parents to talk to kids about emotions and the way that they're in conflict. And, you know, it's the thing that I think makes it somewhat less interesting as a pure movie. It's, you know, sort of lack of stakes and its inability to pull punches, like, makes it more family friendly in the more traditional sense, in that it's like, it's not gonna, it's not too heavy. You can use it as sort of a teaching and talking tool in a way that won't feel too specific to anyone's experiences or will get them overloaded, right? I mean, there's been some conversation on the internet about whether the movie kind of suggests that Riley is gay and then pulls back. And, you know, again, I can totally understand why people would find the kind of maybe suggestion and then, like, total diminution of that suggestion frustrating. But it's also one of the things that, like, makes it kind of successful, right? It's like, it's a movie where families can kind of use it as a schema for talking about their own issues without pushing anybody too hard.
Yeah, if this movie's big reveal had been Riley, it turns out Riley is a lesbian, is interested in the teenage girls, and this movie would not have grossed $150 million in its opening weekend.
It would have been Lightyeared into the sun.
It would have turned into an enormous, you know, culture war football, and it would have been a disaster for Disney and Pixar. I think they were wise to avoid that. I also find I have an issue with the constant insinuations that relationships of that sort, of people of the same gender, like, looking up to each other or being, like, very into, like, almost weirdly homophobic in its own way. Like, there are plenty of relationships where people, like, look up to somebody of the same gender. It's not a romantic thing, you know?
Totally. I do think the use of, like, Peter, there's this sort of ongoing gag in the movie that Riley has, like, a big dark secret locked away in, like, a literal vault in her mind. And in a mid-credit sequence, Joy's like, time to come out. And it's like, the big dark secret is like, I burned a hole in the rug, right? And so it's like, it's more than usual with the reading of these things, like, kind of leans into the, like, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, while still, I think, being plausibly, like, not kind of obviously saying that Riley is gay. So I think it's totally reasonable to interpret it in both directions.
The other thing is, I do think that this movie's success is obviously a big kind of blow against the folks who have been like, Disney is dead, went woke, and they're broke, and this movie is an enormous, enormous hit, and I am hard pressed to find anybody out in culture war land, you know, walking back their death of Disney predictions, because that sort of thing, you know, that doesn't sell.
Wait till we get Snow White, the live action version, next year. I mean, we're already year two of the Disney is too woke. This movie is too woke because of Disney discourse.
Yeah, that'll be fun. I don't know. Moana 2 is also going to be a big hit, I think.
You're looking forward to that, Sonny? That's like you go to sleep at night and you're like, I'm so excited for Rachel Zegler's woke Snow White, and so I can write about it and be mad.
I don't really get mad about that sort of thing, so.
I know.
I don't know. It's,
I know.
It's not really my bag. I mostly just get tired of it. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. All right. So, Alyssa, what do you think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Inside Out 2?
It's fine. It's definitely a totally reasonable thing to do with your family during a heat wave.
It's fine. The strongest thumbs up.
So I should wait until it's on Disney Plus to watch this one.
I think you're fine. I think you're fine with that. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on Donald Sutherland, who passed away last week at the age of 88, the great Donald Sutherland. Sad to see him go, but he was great. We're going to talk about him, how much we enjoyed his work. And now on to The Bike Riders, which is the latest from writer-director Jeff Nichols. My elevator pitch for this movie is basically Midwest motorcycle Goodfellas. And if that sounds like your jam, I think you'll have a ball with this picture. Jodie Comer stars as Kathy, who between the years of 1965 and 1973 submits to a series of interviews with Danny, it's played by Mike Feist, about the formation of the Vandals Motorcycle Club. The club was the brainchild of Johnny, played by Tom Hardy, who decided one day, after watching the Marlon Brando picture, The Wild One, that, hey, it'd be kind of cool to start a motorcycle gang. So he did. So he did. And that's what this movie is about. Kathy winds up in their circle after being silently seduced by Benny, played with smoldering intensity by Austin Butler. And the two of them get married. But Benny's allegiance is to the MC first and Kathy second, to the extent that the opening sequence of the film involves him getting nearly killed by a couple of guys for refusing to take off his motorcycle jacket, his colors, if you will. We start with that jarring bit of violence and then flashback to the origin of the MC. And it just that's just one of the many ways this movie feels a lot like Goodfellas. This movie feels very much like a Goodfellas riff, and I believe that someone told me that Nichols himself actually referenced Goodfellas in the pre-roll that they show at the Alamo Drafthouse. I didn't get to see that because I don't have an Alamo anymore, but maybe you got to see it, Peter. It's a little bit episodic. It's incredibly hypnotic, and the whole thing is just a marvelous actor showcase, right? Beyond the leading troika I've already mentioned, you've also got Michael Shannon, who brings a greasy-haired, wild-eyed intensity to his role. You got Feist, who has been great. He's had a great couple of years. Most recently, we saw him in Challengers. He's very good in that. Boyd Holbrook is doing solid work as a guy who loves carburetors. That's like his whole character is just carburetor guy. The Walking Dead's Norman Reedus is a demented California biker. He, of course, is a real life biker. He's got a whole show about it on, I don't know, AMC, I guess. Damon Harriman, who folks might remember from Justified and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, plays Johnny's number two at the club. He's fantastic in this. Big Love and Boardwalk Empire's Paul Sparks is a rival gang leader. And the guy Happy Anderson, who's just this big bear of a man, and I love seeing him pop up and stuff ever since I saw him in Standoff at Sparrow Creek. He's great in this. I want to give a special shout out to Francine Meisler, who did a great job casting this movie. She's the casting director. She did a wonderful job. Everyone in it is cast perfectly. Everyone just looks right. It's got a verisimilitude that is really wonderful. The whole thing is funny and tender, prone to bouts of occasional violence. It's a fascinating look at the way that media portrayals can influence real-world behavior. I mean, I really cannot emphasize enough how funny it is to see Johnny, who's like a married father of two, decent job as a trucker, mouthing the "what do you got" line from The Wild One and being like, yes, I want to run a motorcycle gang. I'm going to do it. And then he does it. And then the gang blows up out of his control and falls into the hands of raging lunatics. The things we love, the things we make outgrow us. They evolve sometimes in ways we don't like, sometimes in ways we can't control. That's very much a part of this movie and the ethos behind it. I love this. It's pretty great. Peter, what did you make of The Bike Riders?
Well, it's interesting that we ended up doing this as a double feature with Inside Out 2, because The Bike Riders is also a movie about dealing with emotions, but it's about how adult men deal with emotions. Emotions like anger and not fitting in and status anxiety, the desire to be cool, but mostly, I think, anger. Really, just a lot of anger. And it turns out that when you have those feelings and you're a man, you get a leather jacket and a motorcycle and you start a biker gang with your boys who also get leather jackets and motorcycles. And they all join up together. And this is a movie in many ways like Goodfellas, but in some ways more so about that masculine bond and about that masculine stoicism, because none of that stuff is ever really directly addressed. None of the sort of feelings part of this is ever like stated explicitly. It's just sort of like, yeah, I'd like to be cool. Being this middle class guy, just there's something wrong with it, right? We don't know what. It's not enough. He wants a little bit more, and that's why Johnny starts the gang. And so this is kind of in its own funny way an interesting adult and very male parallel to a movie like Inside Out 2. I liked this movie a lot, but I didn't quite love it. And the reason why I didn't quite love it is because after that great first act, which really does recall Goodfellas in so many ways, just down to, you know, the freeze frame with the sort of thesis statement line over it that we get after the first sequence. And the character introductions, you know, which we're sort of meet all of this, all the gang members. It's very much like that Steadicam shot in Goodfellas, where we go around and we meet Johnny two times, who says everything two times. He says everything two, right? And that whole bit, except that instead of a Steadicam, it's sort of it's these kind of posed, almost Wes Anderson-like little intros. That first act is incredible, and it promises a really great movie. But I think the movie slows down somewhat in its second act. And the reason it slows down and doesn't quite deliver what I wanted from it is actually related to the thing I was just saying about male stoicism and the way that this biker, that starting the biker gang fulfills some need that is unstated. And this ends up being a little bit of a problem for the movie in that none of the male characters in the biker gang, the founding members, Johnny and Benny in particular, it's never totally clear what problem this gang is solving for them, what it is they really want, and Benny in particular. So we never see Benny outside, like before the gang. The first time we meet him, he says he'd die for it. Then later we see him seduce Kathy. And then for the second act, he's kind of laid up, right? He gets beat up and he's kind of out of it. He's kind of out of the picture. And at the end, when things get bad and it starts to turn violent, he turns to Johnny and he says, "Is this what we've become?" As if like, well, okay, I would like, that's an interesting idea, right? Like, and I can see what this movie is doing. It treats the gang itself almost as the central character, in some ways independent of the actual human beings who are in it, of the men. Because what we don't see is what drove these men to do this? What was it that they deeply wanted in life? And Goodfellas doesn't have this problem because it tells us from the very beginning, right? The first line is, far back as I can remember, I wanted to be a gangster. And then it shows us over and over again, the wanting and what wanting means. And then in every scene, you get deeper and deeper into gangster culture. And Henry Hill to make choices constantly in which he's like, are you going to go deeper into this dark and violent world, or are you going to, or is this is an opportunity you could pull back? And no, every time he makes the choice to go deeper in, and you see him, the allure of it and the way he loves it. He loves being rich, but he also loves that feeling of power, that feeling of notoriety, that feeling that he can kill somebody if he wants. And you never quite get that sense of what is it that's driving these guys here. You get a sense of the pure and the beautiful, because there's all these montages where, you know, or sort of montage-like scenes of them driving. And it's just wonderful. That second quarter in particular is just kind of, this has this ethereal beauty to it. It's a good movie, but there is something missing in that second act that the first act frankly promises, and it just doesn't deliver.
Well, Peter, can I suggest maybe what you are sensing the film missing? Because I was sensing it too for a while I was watching it, which is that, what does the club actually do? What does it's a motorcycle gang, but what do they do besides hang out and have picnics? Like, are they committing crimes? Like, are they like,
yeah.
This is so, like, there's this moment, the first scene of the film is these two guys go up to Austin Butler's character and they say, why are you wearing, you can't wear colors here. You got to get out of here. So, like, why do those guys dislike having the motorcycle gang around? Is the motorcycle gang bad? Do they commit crimes? And then later we come back to that scene and we do see them commit a crime, but it's really the only crime we see them commit while Johnny is in charge of the gang.
It's frankly the only thing we see the founding members do outside of race motorcycles, right, and hang out and have their their picnics. And there's even this weird thing I believe it's in the first act. It might be the big, it's in the first half of the movie where Kathy's character is talking to Mike Feist's, you know, photographer recorder about their approach to crime. This is as the Austin Butler character is riding out of town, being chased by police. And she says, you know, there's a voiceover bit or where she's explaining, you know, they don't mind getting busted for disturbing the peace. They don't mind, you know, a little bit of rowdiness here and there, but they're not like murder, like the really bad stuff. Well, so that's explained by someone else, and it's barely attached to anything they actually do or any choices that they make in the movie. And this, I think, is the big problem with this film, is it never forces our kind of nominal main characters to make any kind of choice that defines what it is they want and who it is they're willing to be, whether it is that they want to be, you know, sort of dark, you know, a dark crime gang, right? Like, and go deep the way Henry Hill did, or whether they just want to ride around and look cool. And I guess that's it. But like, it's just like, we get the sense of the brotherhood and the loyalty and the beauty of it because it's a beautiful movie and it's wonderfully acted. But we don't get the actual motivation and the drive of those founding members except obliquely through this sense that somehow or another, their lives outside the gang aren't enough, and the brotherhood and the bikes give them a place and a status hierarchy in a society that doesn't accept people like that. Okay, that's something. Like, that's not, like, I can pull that out of there, right? That's not nothing at all. But it's all kind of vibes, and it's not really dramatized.
Well, and Alyssa, one of the things I think that we're getting at here is that the movie, this is actually a movie about ennui. This is a movie about...
For real.
Like, and it's fascinating, too, because it's set... The Vietnam War is never... is not ignored precisely. A couple characters talk about the Michael Shannon's character talks about how he wanted to go to Vietnam. He like went to the draft board and was like,
but he wanted to kill Pinkos.
But Vietnam is not really mentioned, but it is, this takes place from 1965 to 1973. It's like the heart of American involvement in Vietnam.
Sort of Easy Rider era, yeah.
And it really feels like this is like, all right, well, if you didn't go to Vietnam, what did you do? I haven't seen anybody really talk about this. I don't even really know how to talk about it precisely, because it is again like something that is there in the background, but never really drilled down on, never really never focused on that much. But I do think that is a key idea here. It's like, well, all right, it's America. It's a tumultuous period of time. You got guys who lack purpose, who lack direction. What do they do? What do they do with it? And it really is like they watch a movie and they're like, that movie looks like fun. Why don't we do that?
Yeah.
It's fascinating, though, to see the way this movie portrays hippiedom and 70s counterculture and drug culture as actually something pretty awful and something that ruined the early counterculture, which was, in this movie's vision, more stoic, just more experiential, and also very specifically more about beer drinking. And there's a little bit of an interesting parallel there with Oliver, or sort of a reverse parallel with Oliver Stone's Platoon, which really goes out of its way. And Stone has talked about this explicitly, that like this is not just something that happened to be in the movie. That in Platoon, the pot smokers are the peaceful, nice, gentle, good guys, and the beer drinkers are the racist, violent sort of thugs in war. And in this movie, the beer drinkers are the peaceful, nice bikers, and it is the druggies and the drug sellers who come in and are the violent ones who ruin it. And so it's a kind of a facet. Yes.
I mean, that's explicitly bring it back from Vietnam. They say like, these guys came back from Vietnam. They brought heroin and they were all high all the time. And like, and Johnny sees them like sprawled out in the floor and looks at them kind of like with disgust, and like it, and those guys then go and beat up the original members of the gang. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Did you guys both watch Sons of Anarchy?
Yeah,
I watched season one, but that was it.
Yeah. I unfortunately couldn't make the Bike Riders last week. I'm really interested to see it, in part because I like Sons of Anarchy quite a bit. I mean, I think Kurt Sutter gone bananas in some ways, even though I really, really like the early seasons of that show. And in part, what's interesting about Sons of Anarchy is it's very much about a sort of second or almost even like third generation, you know, guy, and like a guy who's basically like a second generation biker. And the idea that sort of moving into more serious criminality has been this kind of deep sin that has corrupted an institution that had, you know, a lot to offer its membership. And so I was sort of curious about the Bike Riders as like almost sort of a prequel to Sons of Anarchy in a way.
Yeah, you know, it's very much about that slide from kind of just a bike driven, a motorcycle driven brotherhood into proper gangdom. I mean, I believe like the final, one of the final shots, you know, the voiceovers, they became a proper gang, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I do think there is an interesting, you know, sort of, there's an interesting kind of counter history of the 70s that I think, you know, is not, has not bubbled up a bunch in popular culture, not least because pop culture really sort of created the image of the 60s, which were actually really in some ways the early 70s. But I do think that, you know, you see some more of that in books like Brian Breaux's Days of Rage and Brendan Koehner's The Skies Belong to Us, where, you know, you see the sort of the kind of seediness and, you know, the death of the dreams of the counterculture or the various countercultures, because talking about the counterculture is monolithic in a way that doesn't reflect the sort of variety of scenes and the sort of the different range of experiences that were very much inflected by class, by geography. So I'll be curious to see it.
Well, this, and this is also a movie that is very bounded, specifically geography. You know, this is a movie about the Midwest, and it's a movie about Midwest, a Midwest motorcycle gang, and how it kind of expanded, and when Norman Reedus
and how
Reedus's
they think of themselves. Yeah, the Norman Reedus character is fascinating because it's an explicit contrast with the California gangs.
Right. Like the guys in the you know, the Chicago motorcycle gang are like, I always wondered what a motorcycle rider from California would be like. And Norman Reedus shows up and he's like this, he like literally he's like a bear. He's like furry and he's got these rotten baked bean teeth and like he's
but also
he's
all
like,
these tassels everywhere, right? Like almost almost like he's doing a sort of you know, a Native American stolen valor sort of thing.
Yeah. It's interesting that this, you know, the Bike Riders is based on a real book that was, again, very much rooted in Midwest photography. But they came after, interestingly, Hunter S. Thompson's Hell's Angels, which was reported more on, like, in San Francisco and Oakland.
Yeah, explicitly California.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a super interesting movie. I'm excited to hear what you make of it once you get a chance to see it, Alyssa. But it's very good. All right. So Peter, what do you make of The Bike Riders? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
It's a good movie. I wish the script gave the main male characters a little more to do dramatically, but it's a good movie and really worth seeing on the big screen because it's beautiful.
Thumbs up from me. I'm pro The Bike Riders. And I like, I really want to see it again because I do, there are interesting things going on in the background of this movie that it takes a little while to pick up on while you're watching it. So keep that in mind if you go see it this week, and you should. Fun movie. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SundayBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.